This program is brought to you by the Museum of the Second World War in Gdansk, as part of the World Battlefield Museums Forum. Welcome. Courage, sacrifice, and heritage are values crucial to understanding battlefields and reflecting on the fate of man and his historic struggles. As places of remembrance and focal points to pay our respects, battlefields bring back images of the past we can explore and research. Preserving and conserving battlegrounds, artifacts, and infrastructure for future generations should be our major goal. Only when this goal is achieved can we think of battlefields as open-air museums and commercial tourism destinations. After all, battlefields are guardians of memory shaping our collective historical identity.
Europe had enjoyed 40 years of relative stability since the Treaty of Paris in 1810. The continent and its colonies were effectively ruled by the Pentarchy, five dominant powers: Austria, France, Great Britain, Prussia, and Russia. But the late 1840s, territorial and national ambitions were beginning to boil over across the continent. The Crimean War was yet another conflict between Russia and the Ottoman Empire for control of the Black Sea Basin. Great Britain, France, and Sardinia, the so-called Allied States, sided with the Turks in wanting to prevent Russian expansion in the Middle East. The destruction of Turkey would have meant Russia's hegemony in the area. In the spring of 1854, the conflict developed from a regional conflict to a clash of major European powers. Patrick Mercer, OBE.
We went to war with Russia because we were trying to support Ottoman Turkey and trying to buy off France, Britain's traditional enemy, by finding a new enemy upon whom to focus, namely expansionist Russia. Russia was looking to increase her holdings in places like the modern Caucasus. Britain did not like her empire being encroached upon, wanted to prop up the Turkish Empire, and similarly wanted to form some form of alliance with the traditional foe, namely France. People are universally condemnatory about the Russian war, and in particular the Crimean campaign, where most of the fighting occurred, because it wasn't thought to be conducted particularly well on the ground. Now, the first point is the fact that this was entirely an amphibious campaign. In other words, every bullet, every nail for a horseshoe, every bit of powder, every gun barrel that we needed had to be delivered onto a hostile shore, namely the Crimea, many thousands of miles away from Britain and from her colonial possessions and from friendly Turkey. Now, the fact that it was sustained for over 18 months entirely by the shipping of France, Britain, and to a lesser extent Turkey, was a very remarkable achievement. Nonetheless, it was extremely difficult. The popular opinion inside the United Kingdom would be that the most important battle, the most memorable battle, was the Battle of Balaclava on the 25th of October, 1854. It was certainly eye-catching. It involved large numbers of cavalrymen, and it involved many members of the British aristocracy. But on the 5th of November, 1854, a great battle was fought at a place called Inkerman, now largely forgotten. But this was a conflict of over 70,000 troops who clashed for the best part of 8 hours just outside Sevastopol, which left over 15,000 casualties, mainly Russian, but also British and to a lesser extent French, and really made sure that the Russians were not able to throw the British and the French back into the ocean before the start of the winter of 1854. To my mind, that is the most significant battle of the campaign. It was extremely bloody. It lasted for several hours, and more Victoria Crosses, Britain's highest award for bravery, were won at that battle rather than any other. More than anything else, the Crimea was a triumph for British bravery, British grit, and British initiative at a low level. Today, I think we concentrate far too much on strategy, the political aspects of military campaigning, and we neglect the fact that unless you have men who are brave, unless you have men who are determined, unless you have men who are prepared to kill the enemy, then battles will be lost. Those are the lessons that we need to remember should the British Armed Forces ever get into action again.
Crimea is a peninsula facing northern Turkey across the Black Sea. The northern and central part of Crimea is covered with a gently sloping plain. The southern part of Crimea boasts three flat-topped mountain chains parallel to the southern coast, creating a mild Mediterranean climate there. The strategic port of Sevastopol is at the southwestern tip of Crimea. Julian Farrance of the National Army Museum, London.
The Crimean War is an interesting war because it's all about technological development in some ways. You've got telegraphs and you've also got the development of weaponry. So the British soldiers have got a new weapon. They've got a rifle. So rifles are not actually that new. They've been around since the Napoleonic period, but only in the hands of specialists. Now we've got all of our soldiers armed with rifles, and what that gives them is much more accuracy and much greater range. So when these Russian cavalrymen come over the top of the causeway and they can see this one solitary regiment in their way, they must be thinking, this is going to be relatively easy. And that may be reinforced when they think that the Highlanders fired a bit too early, because they fire very quickly. And they're doing that because their new weapon gives them that greater range. And they actually manage to break the Russian formation, and the Russian cavalry withdraw back over the causeway into the North Valley. The Times war correspondent that has been mentioned earlier, William Howard Russell, was looking down upon that action, and he said that the Highlanders looked like a thin red streak tipped with a line of steel. And from that point on, British infantry under duress are always referred to as the thin red line. So that's the initial attack. The Russians have managed to get through the Turkish redoubts but have been pushed back, but they're not beaten yet. The cavalry force that's already attacked goes back and joins an even bigger one that's moving down the North Valley towards Sevastopol. And they come cresting over the hill just at the point that the British heavy brigade, the heavy cavalry, have been sent down to try and support those Highlanders who were attacked. And they sort of catch the heavy cavalry out in the middle of nowhere. And bearing in mind that they're on the top of a big causeway, they've got the height, they've caught the British cavalry unawares, they're in a perfect position to just roll down off the hill and completely wipe them out. But the heavy cavalry, under the command of General Scarlett, turns and charges uphill into the Russian formation. That's completely unheard of, but it does work. It surprises the Russians so much that eventually their formation is broken and they give up. His gun redoubts have been captured by the Russians, and he really doesn't want to lose them because he thinks it would look very bad in the press. Lord Raglan decides he's going to have one last action, and he's going to send his light cavalry brigade to go up onto that causeway ridge and skirmish into the redoubts and stop the Russians taking away the cannon. They've got to advance on that position. Now, that's actually not what the commander-in-chief had intended, so he sent them the wrong way down this valley, which Lord Tennyson is going to refer to as the Valley of Death. And that's essentially where they find themselves going. So the light brigade of cavalry advances into the Valley of Death, and they've got essentially cannons directly in front of them. The 3rd Don Cossack Battery is right to their front. They've got the British positions that have been captured by the Russians that are to their south, and they've got Russian positions on the ridges to their north. So they're going into a three-sided box, which opens up on them as they advance into it. And up on the big Sapun Ridge, the general staff can just watch in horror with their mouths hanging open as their light brigade of cavalry melts as it goes down that valley. And above the crackle of the muskets and the crash of the artillery and the screams of the horses, you can hear the troop sergeant screaming, "Close up, close in," as the command essentially shrinks in on itself. Amazingly, they don't break. They keep on going and they hit the battery like a hammer. The soldiers themselves, they are ordered to do an impossible thing that essentially is going to guarantee most of them getting killed, but they get down onto the position and they actually do it. What it does gain is it gains this immortal memory within British society that the charge of the Light Brigade and the Battle of Balaclava will always hold this position because of the soldiers of the 600 Sabres.
Initially, there was a lot of public support for the war. This was the first war with intense media coverage. The telegraph had been developed in 1844 by Samuel Morse, and this allowed messages to be transmitted very fast. Correspondents such as William Howard Russell of the Times were now able to send messages and communicate with the public on a daily basis. Editorials in British newspapers influenced public opinion in favor of Turkey and against Russia. Tsar Nicholas I was portrayed as a brutal despot, having earlier suppressed the 1830 and 1831 uprising in Poland and again in Hungary in 1849. But what was it like for people at the front line?
All the elements of distraction are against us. Sickness and death and nakedness and uncertain ration of salt meat. Horses die by the score every night by their peg from cold and starvation. Worse than this, the men are dropping down fearfully. I saw 9 men of 1st Battalion Royal Regiment lying dead in one tent and 15 more dying. All cases of cholera. The poor men's backs are never dry. They go down to the trenches at night, wet to the skin, lie there in water, mud and slush till morning, go to a crowded hospital marquee, tattered by the storm, and die there in agony. It is my duty as a CO to see and endeavour to alleviate the sufferings and privations of my humble but gallant comrades. I can't do it. I have no power.
This program is brought to you by the Museum of the Second World War in Gdansk as part of the World Battlefield Museums Forum.
Uncensored information, straight from the front lines, was beginning to show a side to this conflict that even Palmerston's enthusiasm and patriotic stance that used earlier to stir up passionate national feelings amongst the population was beginning to lose its effect. And it wasn't just events on the battlefield that made uncomfortable reading.
On Thursday last, we had 1,715 sick and wounded in the hospital, among whom 120 are cholera patients, and 650 severely wounded in the building called the General Hospital, of which we also have charge. When a message came to me to prepare for 570 wounded on our side of the hospital, who were arriving from the dreadful affair of the 5th of November at Balaclava. There were 1,763 wounded and 442 killed, besides 96 officers wounded and 38 killed.
In 1854, Florence Nightingale brought a team of 38 volunteer nurses to care for the British soldiers fighting in the Crimean War. They arrived at the military hospital in Scutari and found soldiers wounded and dying amid horrifying sanitary conditions. More soldiers were dying of diseases such as typhus, typhoid, cholera, and dysentery than from battle wounds. The soldiers were poorly cared for, medicines and other essentials were in short supply, hygiene was neglected, and infections were rampant. The Crimean War also provided an opportunity for subjugated nations to fight for their liberty. Karol Szejko, Museum of the Second World War in Gdańsk.
In the late 18th century, Poland did not exist on the map of the world. It had been partitioned between the three aggressors, Tsarist Russia, Austro-Hungary and Germany. The failed Polish November uprising of 1830 was brutally quenched by the Russians. Thousands of Polish patriots were sent to Siberia, but this did not suppress Poland's drive for freedom. In 1831, Polish political exiles Hotel Lambert group emerged in Paris, and it fueled Polish hopes for independence. It was led by Prince Adam Czartoryski, and this aristocrat lobbied for the Polish cause in France and Britain. So with no country and with no army, in any way they could, the Poles tried to push for freedom. It was believed that the formation of the Polish units fighting against Russia would galvanize widespread political support for the Polish cause. One such opportunity presented itself when the Crimean War broke out, in which Britain and France stood up against Russia. This was exactly what was needed to begin forming Polish military units to fight alongside the Western powers. So Hotel Lambert sent Michał Czajkowski, their envoy, to Turkey. Czajkowski was a Polish poet, political adventurer, and military leader. And in Turkey, he was allowed by the Sultan to assemble an army of Cossacks who had escaped from Russia. The Cossacks were living in the villages on the northern perimeter of the Ottoman Empire. Czajkowski soon converted to Islam and assumed the name of Sadiq Pasha. The commanders of the Cossack unit were Poles, and the unit was named Ottoman Cossacks. The unit itself was a proper ethnic mix. There was a good number of Hungarians, Serbians, Russians, Jews, and Roma. By early 1855, the unit was 800 men strong and had 700 horses. The unit was financed from various sources, including private donations. So, for instance, Prince Adam Zamoyski used some of his own money to buy clothing and boots for the soldiers. Sadly, though, the Ottoman Cossacks did not fight any decisive battles in the course of the Crimean War. The unit was mainly used for reconnaissance missions. But Zamoyski and Czartoryski had also made previous efforts to form a purely independent Polish legion. They had this huge idea to use the Polish legion in a pan-European war that they thought would break Russia's hegemony in Europe. So in late 1855, Adam Zamoyski was given permission by the British government to form the first unit called 2nd Cossacks Ottoman Regiment and then renamed to Cossack Cavalry Division. Zamoyski would often add the word Polish in front of the division's official name to encourage more Poles to enlist. This was a clever trick. The soldiers wanted to serve under the Polish flag and refused to accept the Turkish command, so quite naturally, the Turks refused to support a foreign military unit. Again, the Cossack Cavalry Division did not take part in any major battles, and the unit was soon disbanded. Through Crimean War, the Poles wanted to break the Russia's bondage, and they pinned their hopes on Turkey, but unfortunately, it just didn't work. The Polish mirage of freedom that loomed with the outbreak of the Crimean War vanished rather quickly. In 1863, another January uprising broke out against Russia, and again it failed, and the story repeated itself. Thousands of Polish patriots were again deported to Siberia.
And how is it remembered? Emma Maudsley from the National Army Museum in London.
So the Crimean War is promoted by this museum through our exhibits. We have one of the best collections of relics relating to the battle in the world. We have some really important items relating to Florence Nightingale. We have one of her original lamps. We have her jewellery. We have her medals. We also have some very important battle paintings. We have one by Richard Caton Woodville on the charge of the Light Brigade. We also have the original handwritten order of the launching of the Charge of the Light Brigade. In addition to the poetry and to the artworks, there were paintings that were painted. One of our most popular paintings in the museum is by Richard Caton Woodville, and it was painted in 1897. So it was quite a while after the event, but it was still very popular, and it was actually sold as a supplement to the Christmas edition of Illustrated Magazine, and is one of the most popular paintings in our museum collection. There's also another similar painting by the same artist in Madrid that is equally very popular. Another way that we remember the war is also through sculpture. So there's some very important sculptures in Britain. Florence Nightingale in central London in Waterloo Place. And other people also became famous. A chef, Alexis Soyer, transformed cooking for soldiers, linked to the famous people like Florence Nightingale, people like William Howard Russell, as well as those celebrities from the army. It's a heritage battlefield because it's very much part of the country's consciousness. There are very few battles that have ingrained themselves on the memory of this country. Even though a lot of people don't even know where the Crimea is, they will know about the Charge of the Light Brigade. It's become part of our DNA, partly because of it being quite such a disaster. It's a small group of cavalry soldiers against all odds. And I think in Britain, we do rather celebrate our disasters as much as when we win. We commemorate them almost more than our victories.
The Charge of the Light Brigade by Alfred Lord Tennyson.
Half a league, half a league onward, all in the valley of death, the road to the 600. Forward, the Light Brigade, charge for the guns, he said. Into the valley of death, rode the 600. Forward, the Light Brigade, was there a man dismayed? Not though the soldier knew someone had blundered. Theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die. Into the valley of death, rode the 600. Cannon to the right of them, cannon to the left of them, cannon in front of them, volleyed and thundered, stormed at with shot and shell, boldly they rode and well, into the jaws of death, into the mouth of hell, rode the 600. Flashed all their sabres bare, flashed as they turned in air, sabring the gunners there, charging an army while all the world wondered. Plunged in the battery smoke, right through the line they broke, Cossack and Russian reeled from the sabre stroke, shattered and sundered. Then they rode back, but not the 600. Cannon to the right of them, cannon to the left of them, cannon behind them volleyed and thundered, stormed at with shot and shell, while horse and hero fell. They that had fought so well came through the jaws of death, back from the mouth of hell, all that was left of them, left of 600. When can their glory fade? Oh, the wild charge they made, all the world wondered. Honour the charge they made, honour the Light Brigade, noble 600.
The war was over by 1856. The victorious powers met to discuss terms in Paris. In an interesting turn of fate, France was represented by Count Alexander Colonna Walewski, the French foreign minister, who was a member of both the Polish and French nobility. The Treaty of Paris meant peace for most of Europe for nearly 60 years. But there were unforeseen consequences. Sardinia's involvement in the war signified Italian involvement, and that meant the Prime Minister of Piedmont was invited to the Treaty of Paris peace talks. The Kingdom of Italy was proclaimed just 8 years later. Austria's refusal to engage in the war helped create the conditions for the unification of Germany in 1871. On the military front, the war also led to huge reforms in the British Army. The spectacular bravery of its soldiers and its organizational faults were all very publicly visible, thanks to new communication technology and the resultant media and public scrutiny. Another unexpected development was Florence Nightingale's contribution towards a revolution of the treatment system of wounded soldiers and battlefield medicine. The words of Mary Garofalo of the American National Institutes of Health in Maryland, USA.
The loss of life in the Crimean War was colossal. Of the 1,650,000 soldiers involved in action, 900,000 perished. The majority died from diseases, not their wounds. Florence Nightingale and her volunteer nurses found there was no clean linen, The clothes of the soldiers were swarming with bugs, lice, and fleas. The floors, walls, and ceilings were filthy, and there were rats under the beds. There were 14 baths for approximately 2,000 soldiers, but no towels, basins, or soap. Florence Nightingale was one of the first women to be held in such high esteem during a military conflict. Her work brought the field of public health to national attention. She was one of the first in Europe to grasp the principles of the new science of statistics and to apply them to military and later civilian hospitals. Armed with her experience from the Crimean War, in 1860 she created a nursing school in London, which was the first profane nursing institute in the world. She continued to improve educational standards for nurses and influenced healthcare standards. It can be concluded that without her efforts in healthcare, the world would be a different place.
Carol Shaiko.
The Crimean War ended with Russia's humiliation. Was the sacrifice of the soldiers worth it? Today, the futile loss of life and the scale of human misery during the Crimean War is beyond our understanding. But the war itself shocked the British society and initiated the process leading to a better understanding of human suffering. That war actually defined future generations of the British people. World Battlefield Museums Forum works in collaborations with museums and institutions that commemorate iconic battles. In this program with National Army Museum in London, we bring to you a gripping battle story from Crimea.
The impact of the media was huge, and this was not lost on publishers, writers, or indeed governments or the military. Information had started to become a crucial weapon, but it also led to questions on censorship. For one of history's landmark wars with so many iconic battlefields, it is ironic that the battlefield itself is virtually unmarked and uncommemorated in Crimea itself. There are many lessons to be learned from the Crimean War. Certainly there were blunders, but there was also incredible bravery. The battles led to so much change, yet the battle site is still witness to conflict and bloodshed even now. It is an almost self-fulfilling prophecy that whoever is unaware of history is doomed to repeat it.
This program is brought to you by the Museum of the Second World War in Gdansk as part of the World Battlefield Museums Forum.